Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm your host, Megan, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Nick. Hey, Nick, how's it going today?
Very good. Very good. Happy to be here.
I'm so happy that you're joining me. Just spoiler alert to our listeners out there. This is your first podcast, but I think you're going to do okay. I think so. And I brought you on today because you have a background in cyber litigation and you're well-versed in cyber breaches and coverages for cyber claims. I thought you'd be a perfect match for our guest today, which is Milan Radosevic, who is from Coalition and he handled cyber claims. And when I had mentioned to you that I had spoken to him and I learned that you did cyber, I was like, hey, you want to join me? And I got an enthusiastic yes. So I appreciate that.
Coalition's a great company and really will enjoy talking with them.
Look, cyber claims are huge and they're almost like a silent insurance like attack. And I think I'm going to learn the most here today. So I'm really interested to hear what you guys have to say about that. So with that, let's bring him in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell with your host, Megan Henry.
Good morning, Milan. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. How are you today?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. And I brought on Nick today because we are here to talk about cyber claims. And Nick is our like cyber liability expert at Cruiser Mitchell. So he can really speak your language, I think.
And he was getting,
and when I told him about it, he got all geeked out about it. He's like, oh, yeah, can I come on?
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about managed detection and response, MDR. All right.
It's the little things in life. I guess it's actually, this is like a big thing in life. But before we dive into all things cyber liability, I want to talk to you a little bit, Milan, about how you got where you are, because people are going to be so tired of hearing me say this. So I apologize to everyone listening to this podcast, but I love to hear everyone's background story. And I'm going to ask every single guest who comes on about their background story because I find it interesting. So sorry, but you're all going to have to listen to it too. But I find it so interesting because everyone has just a different path and how they got where they are. And very few got into claims and very few even got into being an attorney because they originally thought that's what they wanted to do. So what's your story? What was your path?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So basically, interesting story. I'm originally from Eastern Europe, from Belgrade, Serbia. I moved to United States 23 years ago. And I live in Atlanta, Georgia. When I first came here, I couldn't even speak English. So I had no idea what I was about to do and how I'm going to go through this journey. But yeah, at some point in my life, after I settled and everything here in Atlanta, I actually went to school for risk management and insurance. After that, I landed the first job in an insurance kind of like a big insurance carrier, one of the major carriers. And I didn't handle cyber claims back then. I just ended up in a claims world after my college. That was the job that they offered to me. And I was like, yeah, I'll take anything. So I landed into claims and it was like commercial auto and general liability claims. So comparing to what I do now, I kind of like think like it's super boring comparing to cyber claims world. Yeah, I did work for the, that insurance carrier for a few years. And at some point, I started looking for other opportunities. I was able to get a job and another insurance carrier where basically they gave me a chance. I didn't have experience in handling cyber claims, but I had a experience handling claims in general. So they were like, hey, there is nobody. That was like back in 2016. Back then, it was like not too many people doing cyber claims. It was like still early stages. So they were like, it's really hard to find anybody with experience. So we understand you don't have experience. We'll train you. So that's how I ended up in a cyber claims. I worked for that company for 3 years. And yeah, I moved after that, like through some other kind of insurance carriers handling the cyber claim.
I just want to back up a little bit and has nothing to do with claims. You said that you came over from Serbia and you ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. How was Atlanta, Georgia where you decided to go? Like, did you have friends or family there? I just find it interesting.
I'm very. That's where it's fingering.
Yeah, like what?
basically, I had no plan, no idea what I'm doing. I would never do it again. When I moved, when I was moving to this country, like I said, I was 26 years old. I had $200 in my pocket, and I didn't speak English. And I was like, yes, I'm going to US, and I'm going to make it over there. But it did work out. And the way I picked up Atlanta, Georgia, it was like typical stories for immigrants, like how I had a friend of mine from my home city, Belgrade, Serbia, living here in Atlanta. Okay. And that was the only reason. I was like, hey, at least I know one person over there. That person offered to help me settle and show me a way around. So I was like, okay, I'm going to Atlanta, Georgia. I had no idea difference between South, North, West Coast, East Coast. To me, it was like all the same. So that's how I ended in...
kind of the American dream, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What was your education level when you came over, Milan? I know you said, did you go to college? So secondary school over here?
I did finish a business school here, but back home, I had a mechanical engineering associate degree. So I made complete change in my, like, in my life and the career. I made a complete change. I'm coming from mechanical engineering background, and I didn't have a lot of experience working in that field, but I did work back home in a mechanical engineering field.
Moving from Serbia to Atlanta, though, like, what was the like shock like for you? Because it's totally different.
it is like completely different. And it's funny, I was just like at the conference a week ago, and I was talking to somebody kind of like similar questions. We had this conversation. Yeah, it was a big shock. My first shock was, like I said, I couldn't speak English when I came here, but I had idea from the movies and from music and stuff like that. I could understand basic conversation. I could not speak English. Anyway, I thought like I have pretty good idea about English language. So I'm landing to Atlanta, Georgia, and first person I talk to is a TSA agent. It's like a Southern gentleman. So he starts asking questions, and I turn around, I'm like, this guy is not speaking English. he had a thick Southern accent. So to me, it was like, I don't know if this is English or something else. Yeah, so it was a big cultural shock. Everything was bigger. One of the things that kind of like caught my attention early, Atlanta is, no, it's a big city, but when I came here like 23 years ago, it was like much smaller. It was more like a suburb type of living style. And to me, it was everybody's in the cars comparing to Europe. Europe, you got the busy streets, kind of like New York City vibe. But over here it was different. It was a southern city. So I'm like, everybody's in the cars. I don't see people around. And in the beginning, it was like really big shock for me.
Yeah.
Like,
interesting.
I didn't like that I cannot use public transportation. I have to use my car to go anywhere, even for simple grocery trip to purchase something simple. I was like, it takes too much time. I always have to be in a car. I like to be hanging out with the people, walking on the streets, using public transportation. So that was
like Chicago. Have you ever been to Chicago?
I like Chicago. Chicago is like reminding me of that European cities. So.
Yeah, a lot of public transportation here. I walked from Union Station this morning. So a lot of walking, a lot of shared routes. So there is a lot of interaction in Chicago.
Were you like at that time, people like, wait, why did I choose this place? And no knock against Atlanta at all. I'm just like, sounds like it was just, it was so different. And you probably were like, man, maybe I should have picked somewhere I could walk around a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm pretty sure a lot of immigrants going through the same phase, which is normal. It's like in the beginning, it's a big shock. Then you start questioning yourself. Did I make the right decision? I had a couple of situations where I was thinking like, you know what, maybe I'll just go back to Europe, but I didn't. So it was over time, I got used to it. So now I feel this is my home. When I go visit my family in Europe, I spend time over there. I love it. But I, after a while, I'm like, I'm missing Atlanta. Yeah. I want to go back.
Yeah.
It's funny what you mentioned about like coming over though, not knowing the language and, you know, knowing some from movies, because a good friend of mine moved over here in her like 20s, didn't know any. She moved over from Siberia, pretty much learned English from like watching soap operas. Like those stories you hear about, like she's like, yeah, no, I did that. I learned at the beginning from watching television.
Yeah, that's how we in Eastern European countries, yeah, you watch American movies and listen to music. That's how you kind of pick up the basics. Then when I first moved here, my first job was in a hotel. I was doing valet and stuff. So I was close to a lot of people. I did use that for me to kind of like practice and start speaking. And it was kind of like embarrassing in a lot of situations. But I was like, you know what? I have to communicate with the people. So I would just be honest, like, hey, look, I came 2 months ago. My English is not good, but let's have a conversation.
Did you find that people were willing, when you're honest like that, people were willing then to, oh, okay, and then like, and be very helpful to you?
Yeah, exactly. That's my experience. Yeah. When you put it that way, and when you're honest, like, hey, look, I know I'm making grammar mistakes. I'm still doing it. You'll probably hear it. But I was like, I know I'm not good in this, but help me. Yeah. And I was always like, hey, how do you say this? What I should say? And stuff like that. So yeah, people in general, when you approach it like that, they were like super helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You came over though, and you had a background in mechanical engineering. Why didn't you explore that career path?
Yeah. So basically when I came here, yeah, that was the natural kind of like idea just to continue what I was doing. Anyway, I had, like I said in the beginning, when I moved to the United States, I had idea that I might not stay here and that I will go back. Back home in my country, mechanical engineering field was not in the best kind of like position for jobs and stuff like that. The jobs were not paying much. There were not enough jobs because my country, the country I come from, we went through a lot of trouble in the 90s. There was like a civil war. The whole industry was destroyed. No jobs. That's one of the reasons I came over here, because there was kind of like for younger people back then in those days, there was like no future over there in terms of career and stuff like that, to be financially stable and so on. Pretty much my generation, everybody was looking for a way to get out of there. So yeah. I had the idea to go back to Serbia potentially at some point. And I'm like, I don't want to be a mechanical engineer over there making $200 a month. Like, let me go to business school, because I was thinking business school will give me education for whatever I decide. If I stay here, I'll be good. If I go back, I'll be good too. Mm-hmm. So that was the kind of like my reasoning for changing that course.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. And hearing the environment that you came from and like how that pushed you to move it. But also like when I hear mechanical engineering, like that's a lot. It's not like any silly business. Like it's a lot of technical.
Right. It is. Yeah. And it's not, I sometimes use those skills in kind of like, I work with a lot of claims people, which have legal background, a lot of attorneys, and typically they are impressed with my math skills, like when we have some type of calculation or something, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is how you do it, and they're like, oh my god, you're a god, like
you're a genius.
Right.
They say I went to law school because I can't do math. I mean, that's my, you know, that's kind of a common joke. So do you find, I mean, math's one thing, but how much do you find that your background helps you now in what you're doing as a claims person? Engineering background, here's my thought. Engineering background, you're learning a lot about how things work, looking at the details of something, figuring out if you push something here, what's going to happen over here, kind of a cause and effect thing. Do you find that that helps you with, for example, understanding how a policy works, understanding how coverage or a claim might flow through a policy?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that background helps me. And I find a lot of kind of like areas where, coming from the mechanical engineering background, especially handling cyber claims, before this podcast, I was on a call with I'm handling kind of like a complex ransomware claim that came in this morning. The whole company is crippled. So the production stops, everything stops. It helped me to understand, for example, business interruption portion of the claim. Specifically, these people that I talked to this morning, they have 20 locations, they have retail, they have production. So everything stopped because of cybersecurity incident. So yeah, it does help me a lot to understand potential business interruption implications, to understand what needs to be done in terms of system restoration. Do we need to purchase new equipment, or can we recover from backups and all those things? It does help me.
That is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that from a business interruption standpoint. Right. Having that technical background that you have helps you better to understand when an insured's telling you, hey, we can't operate right now because X, Y, and Z are down. That's interesting. Well, some of the biggest business interruption claims I've handled involve manufacturing facilities. I'm thinking of one right now that was out in Nebraska, exact same thing. Systems got hit. The equipment stopped working, production stops, they're not meeting contractual requirements with third parties. Yeah, that's to understand that on the ground, because it's not just numbers too. You hire forensic accountants to deal with that.
Right, right.
But really understanding and talking with the insured and making them feel comfortable that they're being heard because you have that background. That's interesting.
Exactly, yeah. I feel like I can kind of like have that conversation with them, understand right. what they're going through. And they appreciate that. It's a stressful situation for them, but they appreciate, like, I understand actually that the company's down and they cannot operate. So their main concern is like how we get up and running, how we distribute the products, how we follow up with all orders that we already have and stuff like that. So I'm pretty sure you went through those scenarios many times.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I have a math background, and I actually think that having that analytical background really helps. What people, I think, fail to understand a lot, too, about, like, math isn't accounting. Like, accounting is something totally different, and math is very analytical, logical thinking, working through problem solving and a step-by-step process. So, I remember even taking the LSATs, like, that whole logic game section, to me, I was this is just a big, fun math game. This is great.
You were by yourself on that.
I was.
That was all. I hated the logic game.
I buy books today and I do them. Like, I enjoy it's like my Sudoku. Like, I love doing those types of analytical games. My daughter loves it too. It's fun for me. So I hear they're getting rid of that part of the LSAT though. So
Really? No, that's part of the gauntlet, right? Awful. Absolutely.
I could do without reading comprehension. I'm totally sidetracking, but I talked to my daughter about this too. And she's like, oh, yeah, on those standardized tests, those reading passages. I was like, oh, I know they're the worst. I'm like, but you just have to think you're going to learn something. Every single time you read one of those reading comprehension passages, you're learning about something new.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't follow up too much. Like, I wish I have more time to kind of like do the same things you do, but yeah, like, before, when I was like back home in a college, in a school for mechanical engineering and stuff like that, when I moved here, I remember when I decided I want to go to business school, they had to do kind of like evaluation to kind of like see on what level I am. I didn't prepare at all. And I know that a lot of people here would spend some time to prepare for those exams. And I didn't prepare at all. I went to the school. They were like, hey, we need to test you. It was some type of tight deadline. So basically they were like, you either do it today or you have to wait next semester or whatever. And I was like, you know what? I'll just do it today. And I did it perfectly. It was.
You're one of the few. I'm like you, Milan. So for the LSAT, speaking of the LSAT in particular, it was like $1,000 or $1,500 for the course to train you. And specifically those logic games, there's an entire strategy of how to kind of map that out as you're going to help you with it. I wouldn't spend the $1,000 or $1,500 at the time because I didn't want to take that course. And I'll just go in and wait. I didn't get the best score that I think I could have gotten had I gone and done the strategy. Fast forward after law school for the bar exam, I turned over every stone you possibly could, studied as hard as I could because I was like, I'm going to do this one time, never come back for the bar exam again. But yeah, initially I was the same way, just kind of go in and give it your best shot and hope for the best, I guess.
I was doing all kind of like stuff when I was younger. I was like, you know, you don't think that much. You don't put analysis into that. That's why I said I would not make decisions that I made before. I would not do it today. For example, going to complete foreign country with no money, no plan, no nothing, kind of like. But back in the days, I was that way. I was like, yeah, I'll do it today. I'll whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, we realize a little bit how much some things, how much they impacted our life and how much the direction where that could have gone. If I would have absolutely bombed the LSAT, maybe I never would have gone to law school. If I would have thought that going in, I sure would have paid the $1,000 or $1,500. Right. But it worked out. In the end, it all worked out anyway. So
yeah. Let's get back to you and claims. You talked about how you started a carrier and you're doing like motor vehicle type claims, but how did you eventually segue into cyber?
So basically at point I was like, claims, especially like if you're in an entry-level claims position, it's a lot of volume. It was a lot of claims, a lot of kind of like pressure with the workload. So at some point I start looking for, let's see what else I can do. Can I go to underwriting or can I do something else? So basically I start looking for opportunities out there. Since I had the experience in the claims, this carrier was willing to kind of like interview me for the cyber position. At that point, I didn't know anything about a cyber and privacy claim. Yeah, I mean, it was good conversation. They felt like I would be a good fit and I would learn quickly. That was my selling point. I was like, look, I went from mechanical engineering to business school and I'm learning fast. Give me a chance. I'll show you I can do the job. So they were like, yeah, that sounds good. And that's how I started. I started with a kind of like entry-level cybersecurity claims handling position.
Yeah, and not even just mechanical engineering in business school. In Serbia. And now you're here in the, I mean, you definitely, I would think they had a good confidence level that this is somebody who can adapt, learn things, and has a willingness to do so, obviously, with your track record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about cyber claims in general. And this is where Nick gets to geek out a little bit and you can geek out a little bit and I can just facilitate. When I think of cyber claims, like I think of things like the issue that happened at Sony a few years ago with, I remember when they got all the information, they got the text messages or the emails from all the celebrities. Like that's what I think about. So that may or may not be the reality. What kind of claims are you seeing on the daily, or I guess not daily because they're larger and you might not get a new claim every day. The volume is less, but what are you really seeing right now?
So yeah, the majority of the claims that we are seeing, I put them in a group. There is like three kind of like main type of incidents that we see. It's phishing emails, business email compromise. That's the a lot of those claims. We see a lot of those. Then funds transfer fraud claims and ransomware. So those are three kind of categories that I see a lot. Yeah. And basically there is no limitations who they're attacking as far as the industries, bad actors. They can attack Sony and get hold of the information that is kind of like interesting for the public, to all the talks like, yeah, celebrities and stuff like that. But in the real world, it's happening like to everybody. It's happening to law firms. It's happening to healthcare organizations, schools. So there is basically, there is no kind of like limitations. So yeah, those that you mentioned, they typically hit the headlines and the news, but it's happening everywhere on a daily basis.
Yeah, and Megan, it's happening every day to us, right? We all get those emails. I've seen notices as recent as yesterday that we're getting those phishing emails like Milan is talking about, where they're trying to pose as something that they're not, and they're trying to get you to click on a link, or the recent trends are QR codes, trying to get you to scan that. Yeah. They'll pose as HR people. It was dangerous recently here in our office in Chicago. Milan, we just opened up the Chicago office. My group came over and joined Cruiser Mitchell in January and opened Chicago. Right away, we're getting those phishing emails the minute we pop up on the webpage. That's what they're watching. And they're posing as HR people. And so I was really concerned and made sure everyone in our office knew, if you get an email, it's saying it's a QR code, it's HR. That seems legitimate right now because we were opening a new office. They need your information. Don't scan it. Don't click on it. Check with us first. We'll reach out to headquarters, and our headquarters is down in Georgia as well. So we're seeing that. There's no target that's too small. They're sending it everywhere. And then, Milan, I'm sure what you're handling too with those is like the social engineering or fraudulent instruction claims. Those are just so rampant. And I mean, we see those constantly.
First of all, I'm so paranoid about the phishing emails. Like you said, Nick, we all receiving those emails. So there is no protection from that. You will receive the phishing email. So you just have to kind of like be careful. So I'm
it's
super
not
paranoid.
Prince of Nigeria, right?
It's not. Yeah. Yeah. It's not like that anymore. They're sophisticated right. now. So it's so easy to fall for it. When you're busy, something happening, something going on. I just heard somebody, it was a test. In our company, it was a test, basically, just to see if the employees will fall for the phishing email. Mm-hmm. So the employee requested some expense to be approved, travel expense or whatever. So the boss responds like, hey, it's denied. If you want to see the reason, click here. So the person clicked.
Yeah.
And hey, you got caught. You clicked on a phishing link. Those are kind of like, yeah, very sophisticated.
So that was a real email. So was there a security breach where someone was in monitoring the boss's email?
No, this was just like exercise.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
To see real life scenario. But I'm pretty sure it's happening in real life.
But that seems, I think a lot of people would fall for. I've definitely seen similar ones on my end too. Oh, here's your payroll report. I never click on it because it's usually not, it's not a PDF. And like, well, if it were a real payroll report, it would probably be a document. And it's usually like a link to something, but it is believable. Oh, well, yeah, maybe that's how I see my pay stub. I don't know. They're savvy. They're very, very savvy. And we're attuned to it. And there's a lot of people who aren't, and they're going to click on the link. Like my mom would definitely click on the link. She has.
And it's happening.
I are in this every day. And I see those emails and it gives me, if I even pause, have a hesitation for just a second, I think, geez, people who aren't paying attention to this and doing this every day and know maybe what the recent trends are, they're probably clicking on that. Right. And then you don't know how far down the line they're going. Usually you have to give a little more information or scan something. What I've seen a lot lately, I wonder if you've seen this, Milan, is title agents are such a huge target. People who handle like commercial closings, real estate transactions.
Yeah.
And the threat actors are very, very smart in how they deal with them. They will infiltrate, they'll breach the system, and they don't just start acting right away. They'll monitor emails for a while. They will track specific transactions. They'll watch until you get to the very end and you're starting to exchange information for the wire transfer of funds. And they'll either intercept the legitimate instruction or they'll say, well, here's an updated instruction or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if the title agent doesn't use a two-factor authentication or multi-factor, meaning that they reach out to the sender to verify the information, those funds get diverted. So, I mean, I've seen a $10 million commercial closing where the funds get diverted to the threat actor's account.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, Nick, and that's what I was about to kind of mention. Yeah, like the threat actors, their goal is not just for you to click on a phishing email or provide credentials. Their goal is to monetize their breach. So they're looking for ways to do it. One of the easiest way and the most attractive way for them is funds transfer fraud schemes or social engineering, what Nick just explained. So basically, once they have access to that email account, typically they target CFO or CEO or somebody like that who handles or accounts payable department or somebody like that. So when they get access to that, they start monitoring that communication. They learn who is doing what the victim is about to pay, what invoices, who are the players in that communication. So they kind of take time to figure out how to execute. So at the right point, when there is a closing, like Nick said, there is a closing date, today is a closing, they're like, hey, here is the updated transaction information. Here is where you need to send the money. And they provide the fraudulent account. So that's typically how they execute that. And yeah, it can be transactions in a million.
Absolutely. Is part of your coverage, Milan, do you require insureds either right within the, I've seen policies where right in the insuring agreement, it requires that you have procedures adopted and that you follow those for authenticating any monetary transfer, any wire transfer.
Right.
Is that part of your policy or do you require that of insureds now to have multi-factor authentication for wire transfers?
So yes, some policies, it just depends. Some policies, they have that requirement, some policies don't. I don't know how they decide that on the underwriting side. Mm-hmm. It relates to the type of businesses we write to. So yeah, the banks, I believe that financial institutions that are doing the transactions on a daily basis and title companies, on those policies, we do require secondary method of authentication. So basically, the policy would require, hey, when you receive the change in any type of payment from your vendors, you have to authenticate it by the secondary method, which is picking up the phone. If you receive instructions via email, you cannot just respond via email, hey, is this legit? Because the bad actor will respond, yes, it is, of course, go ahead, do it.
Right.
So you have to pick up the phone and use secondary method.
And not just pick up the phone too, right? Call a known phone number, something that's already on file. Don't look at the phone number that the threat actor put in email, which, by the way, I've had a claim before where the threat actor left a phone number on there and our insured called. They answered and said, yep, that's the right number. if you're authenticating with them, you know, they're just going to read the number back.
Or if they provide invoice or something like that, the invoice manipulation scenarios or stuff like that. Yeah, like Nick said, they would provide instructions where to send the money. And they would say, hey, if you got any questions, here is the number you need to call. And you call that number, they pick it up. The bad actors pick it up and say, yeah, go ahead, do it.
Right.
Send the money.
But if you're in the midst of this, right, and you don't know this is happening, like you're going to call that number. Right. Like, unless you are suspecting of something, and the way these emails and everything is like put in front of you, it looks authentic.
Right.
So I think it's real challenging for someone to actually know what's happening because it seems all authentic. Right.
Right. And that's a great point, Megan. And I think and Milan's company, Coalition, does a great job on proactive measures for insureds. People don't realize with cyber coverage, the value you get in getting educated by your carrier. Hopefully they're doing things ahead of time to tell you what the schemes are, to look at the systems that you have up, to your policies and procedures in place. Having those ahead of time is one, I mean, obviously helps them because they're not going to have as many claims, hopefully. But two, they're helping their insured because when these things happen, you have a system breach, like Milan was talking about the manufacturing facility that goes down. That's a lot bigger deal than just the claim you're going to have with your insurance company. If you're unable to fulfill contracts, it may ruin relationships forever. It could bankrupt your company and not everything may be covered, or, you know, you're not going to have limits that are going to cover everything that puts you out of business. So Milan, I wonder if you can comment at all on kind of, I think I mentioned it earlier, but the managed detection and response, or in the industry we call it MDR, that Coalition offers to insureds and kind of helps them prepare and educates them for these types of things.
Yeah, so Coalition and some other insurtech companies, I'm pretty sure, Nick, you're familiar with what insurtech, but that's kind of a new trend in the insurance world for people who are not closely into this field. The insurtech companies start popping up lately in last, let's say, 10 years or so, which are kind of like a hybrid companies of insurance and tech companies. So company I work for, Coalition, they're insurtech company. They like to think about themselves more as a tech company. So they're providing cybersecurity services to clients. And basically our goal is to prevent the incident. So we are helping clients to avoid altogether being in a situation to have a claim. One of the things that we are doing differently than traditional carriers, we would scan the client's network for vulnerabilities. Basically, we would do same what the bad actors are doing, scanning for vulnerabilities. If we detect vulnerability, we would notice that client saying like, hey, look, you got a backdoor open here, or you have RDP port open. You need to close it. If you don't close it, well, sometimes in extreme situations, we can be like, hey, look, we're going to condition your coverage. If you don't close this, then there might be issue if you got a claim after that. So kind of forcing them to keep the system secure and in a good kind of like security state. So that's what we are doing. We also, on a proactive basis, we communicate with the clients. It's not like we just react. When something bad happened, we just react. On a daily basis, communicating with them about vulnerabilities, about they can log in into the platform, see any red flags, resolve those red flags and stuff like that.
Right, right. And by now, I mean, this is like if your auto carrier came out and checked your car out for you and made sure everything was safe and that the car seats were in the right way and everything else. There is so much more that you get with cyber insurance. And really, every business should have some form of cyber insurance at this point, because we're all working on computers. We all rely on them so much.
Even the smallest businesses, you're still connected to things online, and you're still connected to banks and your money and your company's money. And it's funny, like my family has a small restaurant in Connecticut. And if I were to go to my brother and be like, how's our cyber coverage? My brother would be like, Megan, we don't even take credit cards. But we are on DoorDash now. So I'm like, well, you might want it now.
I actually have seen a small restaurant claim, though, relating to a cyber policy, because they used a managed service provider for credit card transactions. And the managed service provider had a breach, couldn't process the transactions. Or I think I had one, too, that was a social engineering one where it said, for our transactions that you're processing, forward the money over to this account now. So, I mean, yeah, it touches everything. But yeah, I guess if they're all cash, they're one of the few still immune, I guess.
Yeah, but I see claims with restaurants involved. So yeah, definitely they got hit. Funds transfer fraud, they can pay, instead of paying a vendor, they are paying the fraudulent account and stuff like that. Yeah, email compromises and point of sale devices and stuff like that. Right. Yeah.
And so with funds transfer fraud, what Milan is talking about, so you owe money to company X for the widgets, the threat actor will direct you to pay them as opposed to company X, saying maybe their wire information has changed or something like that. And what often happens in this situation is you pay the money, it's gone, the threat actor takes it, you turn to your carrier to provide for the loss. But then in the meantime, you also get company X who's saying, hey, we don't care what happened, we still didn't receive the money, right? And they've got their own obligations, and there's kind of a domino effect of really damages that start happening. I would say, and I'm sure Milan will agree with this because he was talking about something that just came in this morning, these claims in cyber are so time sensitive, whether it's a business is down, or someone can't fulfill contractual obligations, or payment wasn't made, and now they're going to cut off services to the insured, something like that. It's always so time sensitive to respond to the insured and help them with whatever they're dealing with.
But with the time sensitive nature, though, and this is where I'm a little naive, because can it be going on for a while before you realize it? Right? Like your network could be infiltrated long, like weeks before you have any idea.
Yeah, and typically that's a typical scenario. Even on our ransomware claims, the threat actor, once they got access to the system, they move laterally through the system. They look what they can steal, where is the sensitive data. Sometimes it takes weeks for them to basically execute the ransomware. When the client or the victim realize there is a ransomware, that's like the final stage. Basically, at that point, the threat actor, you can imagine, like, hey, break into the house, they search the house, they steal the stuff. On the way out, they burn the house, like, to hide the evidence and just to leave. So at that point, the damage is done. That's when you see the ransom note, basically saying, like, hey, look, your network was compromised. Please contact us to kind of negotiate.
Yeah, I like that analogy, right? Because once you see the smoke, to go to Milan's analogy, once you see the smoke, it's already done. They've already sat on your couch. They already ate your sandwich. They've already taken your data. Once you know that the successful threat actors, once you know, they want you to know. Usually, I mean, that's the situation.
All I see in my head is Ocean's 11.
Right.
The fake vaults, the money. Yeah, exactly. That's all I'm picturing in my mind.
Well, now with deep fakes too, I don't know if Milan, if you've had any deep fakes yet in your claims, but that's scary.
These things all have really juicy terms. So what's that?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't see any claims with the deep fakes, but yeah, that's hot topic right now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the media right now. So deep fakes are where they're AI generated. So for example, I believe there was a recent one where an individual, I think he was in Tokyo or something, thought he was on a call, a Zoom call or something like that, with his boss, and sat there, was on a half an hour call talking with his boss. And during that call, what he thought was his boss told him to transfer $25 million. And he thought, okay, well, then once the call's done, all right, boss told me to do this. So he goes and wire transfers 25. Well, it was, the entire thing was fake. It was a deep fake. It was AI generated.
Wow.
image of his boss, my understanding is correct, deep fakes to you or I would appear to be the same thing. You would think you're talking to me right now, but only counter AI can detect a deep fake.
So yeah, what do you do? I'm having a hard time imagining how that works. I mean, AI is amazing how it works and how it spits out. If you go into ChatGPT, what it spits out with very little information. But the video part is what gets me in the having the conversation. But I guess it works the same way. But I'm just thinking about the video movement. Yeah.
So the technology, I don't know. But yes, part of the concern going forward is just, I mean, think of it like in a criminal context. Mm-hmm. What happens to reasonable doubt at this point? You might think you have something on video. Someone's caught red-handed, right? But what happens to reasonable doubt now? I'm sure there will be experts in you and they can, you know, through technological means, determine if something was real or if it was fake. But boy, I mean, you know, I know that some companies were giving loans based upon recorded calls. Well, what if somebody says they default on the loan? And they say, I never took the loan. That was a deep fake. I mean, what if that's their defense now?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think what it's going to happen, and I wonder Milan's thought, but it's going to change the way that we do business. A wire transfer. I mean, there's already two-factor authentication, but maybe we say, no, you can't do it. Don't ever take an instruction through any technological means, whether a phone call, an email, or over a Zoom call, only in person. Only certain people have certain levels of authority to make a wire transfer. It's just going to be it's a lot of safeguards, and it's going to change the way we do business.
In that scenario, it's almost like a return to what it used to be, physically having to walk into a bank. It's like changing the tides. Like we move so much in this digital arena that your bank branches are closing down. And now it seems like maybe though it's going to take a few steps back. The physical presence is going to be necessary.
Yeah. In the cyber world, this is new. Deepfakes are new. So, I mean, in the cyber insurance, the threat actors start using it. Yeah. Nick said, we will have to adapt. We went through these phases with ransomware, with funds transfer fraud, early stages. We learned the lessons and we tried to adapt. But from my perspective, like you said, Megan, typically the solutions are going back to the basics. You can do so much with the technical things and the preventions, but it goes back to the basics. Pick up the phone, talk to the real person. Okay, so now we got deepfakes. That's kind of problematic. I think we're going to go back, like you said, like you need to see the person physically, see the person and talk to the person or stuff like that.
Interesting though. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's been in the back of my mind, and I don't know if you guys would even have the answer to this, but where are these threat actors located? Is it or do we even know? Like I imagine them like in this like dark room in the basement, like with 18 screens around them, and it's like just one individual. Like, that's what I'm picturing in my mind. But like, what do we know about it? Do we know anything about it? And are we able to even track it really?
Yeah, there is a law enforcement always trying to kind of track them down and see if they can stop their operation. So I'm pretty sure that Nick is aware there is a big news. Good news for us, the biggest threat actor group out there, Lockbit, is actually, it's down. Collaborative law enforcement action between UK, FBI, Interpol in Europe. So they were able to take this group down. And that's kind of like just happened last week. So that's big news. But yeah, typically it's hard to track them. Yeah. And it's hard for our law enforcement to do anything about it because in a lot of cases, these groups are protected by the state. So in a lot of cases, they're sitting somewhere in Eastern Europe, in Russia specifically. A lot of them are Russians and they're protected by their state. So, you know, even if we got any information, any leads, they're not going to arrest them over there. So,
From forensics, because what you'll do in the typical scenario is there'll be a suspected breach, and then the carrier, through usually approved vendors, almost always approved vendors, they'll get like forensics to come in. A company will come in and look to see, you know, was there a breach? Was there any exfiltration of data? That sort of thing. We almost don't even ask anymore. It's not always relevant from my perspective, but the carriers do want to know, maybe can we identify which group it is or that sort of thing. A lot of times the best information you can get is just really what country did it come from. That's it.
Yeah.
So good luck catching them, stopping them. As far as the groups, you had given, you know, what people envision is some guy down right in a hooded sweatshirt down in a basement, dark basement with a bunch of screens around them. It's not like that anymore. These are professional organizations with an office setting, large staff that come in and work regular days, and it's big business now. Times have changed and these groups are much more professional and their tactics are much harder to detect than what we used to seeing in the past.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, the great point. People typically imagine one guy in a garage, but those specifically ransomware threat actor groups, those are big organizations. They operate like a company, basically. They have HR department, they have customer service department, they have structure. I don't know exactly how big the group is, but it's a big organization. So they're smart. They know what they're doing. It's not easy to kind of like go against them. So it's always that, yeah, that game.
Right. Well,
and they're well-funded because they're stealing money.
They're stealing money, yeah.
What's really interesting too is that these organizations like Lockbit, you know, they want some credibility. There is something tied to their name now. There is a reputation to uphold in the way that they do business. And an interesting part of this that I've talked with insureds with before, when we get to a point where we negotiate ransom and we're going to pay a ransom, is that the most, I assume Milan's going to agree that this is like a common question you get, and I've never had a great answer. The insured will say, well, what guarantee do I have if I pay this ransom? Right. And their promise is really, okay, it's not going to go to the dark web. Here's the decryption key. You'll get your information back. We'll delete the files that we have. How can you trust them?
You can't.
Right. And that's what we say. We say, well, however, that being said, a lot of groups understand that if they don't come through with what they say they're going to do, we keep tabs on who we're dealing with too.
Yeah.
We're not going to pay the next ransom. If you burn us, the cash is done. Okay. We'll have to deal with the insured in some other way, but they understand that they have to gain some credibility there for the next time that they breach.
Yeah.
Right. So typically they keep the promise in terms of they provide decryption key and stuff like that. We are learning right now with the Lockbit and with other groups that were taking down that they kind of lie about deleting the data that they stole. They keep it. They provide evidence kind of like they deleted the data, but it seems like they're not doing it. But they promise they're not going to put it on a dark web and so on. But to Nick's point, they are serious about the reputation. And if they promise something, they typically try to do that, because if they don't, that would be their last deal. Next time, if we deal with that group, we would not make a payment, because everybody in the industry will know, hey, Lockbit, they received $2 million for the ransom. They didn't provide the decryption key. So from that point, everybody will be like, okay, what's the point of paying them?
Yeah.
Right. So they want to keep their business going too.
Yeah. And I mean,
you call it business. Like.
Yeah. Right. And if you think of it that way, that's their business and the product they're selling you is to give you an out, even though they're the one that creates. So to Milan's hypothetical, they're the one that started the fire. And now they're selling to you the idea that they're going to put the fire out for you.
Yeah.
Now, if you can get past the idea that you're the one that caused it, I'm not going to pay you anything. But if you make the business decision, the product they're selling you is that ability that you can trust them now that they're going to put the fire out. They're going to give you back the data, not sell it on the dark web. So they are selling something, and that's the only way that they can really monetize it, if you can kind of believe them at that point.
Yeah. Well, I'll trust you now.
Yeah, we'll trust you now. Even when you started the fire, okay, yeah, you say you'll put it out.
And I have those conversations with the clients on a daily basis. It depends. We always have discussion before we make decision to make the payment. Our kind of position is we don't want to pay if we absolutely have to pay that.
Right.
Then basically, that's the question. And I try to explain to the clients like, hey, look, we are paying the promise from the criminal. So that's what we are paying. The damage is already done. Data was stolen. Mm-hmm. Now we're just paying promise that they will not leak it on a dark web or share it.
So they'll give you a decryption key. Part of it is you're going to pay, and they'll give you like a test key. And then you can test it and get some data back so that they can show you, if you pay us, you know, we'll give you everything back. but here to test it, we'll prove to you we're the ones that did it, and we can give you that access back. And caring about their reputation to it. So it's interesting, a thing that's happened recently, the SEC came out with some new rules, and there's a rule if you have what's deemed a material breach, material to that specific business. Within 4 days of discovering it and determining it's a material breach, you have to report it to the SEC. The threat actors now, they're breaching systems, and they care about this stuff. They want the publicity that they breached your system. If they don't see the report to the SEC, they have gone themselves and reported on companies. Hey, we breached them, and they didn't tell you about it, SEC. So it's kind of interesting. Like, they want it to be told on. They want everyone to know that they're doing it.
Right. That's the way they're putting pressure on the client to make the payment. Yeah, they are getting more and more aggressive. Basically, yeah, sometimes they reach out to the companies, to the victims' clients, and be like, hey, did they tell you, same scenario, did they tell you they had a breach? And the clients would be like, no, we don't know about it. Then, you know, it's all kind of like reputational harm in place and all that. Then they're just putting pressure on the victim to make the payment.
It's like them going to the neighbor's door and saying, hey, did you see the fire over there?
Right, right.
You're hypothetical. No one has called yet. You guys better call the fire department.
Right.
I find this so fascinating. It's so different from what I do on a daily basis, but like obviously Nick is like in his, you're in like your happy sandbox right now.
Geeking out, yes.
And I think I could like wind you up and let you two go forever, go forever on this. But it's also scary. It's scary how prevalent it is and how seemingly easy it is and how expensive it can be for a company. And again, it goes to the point that you need to get that policy, you need to get that coverage, because you know, no business is immune to it.
And with cyber too, what I have found in helping insureds, because I've worked everything from being the point of first contact, probably similar to what Milan does working with the insureds, to, you know, I represent insurance companies, so I've also represented as coverage counsel disputing coverage. But helping insureds in these situations has been some of the most rewarding work I've done at all as an attorney, because it's a situation that they are not prepared for a lot of times. And you are truly helping them. And it's so time sensitive. It's such a big deal to them and their business. It's a rewarding experience to feel like you're really helping them through the coverage. And there's so many different coverages too. You've got first party coverages, you've got third party coverages. So love what I do, love doing cyber work, it's obvious. And I think it's a great job. I think Milan's job is very rewarding.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It's super rewarding. Yeah. Sometimes, like I said, in the beginning, when everything happens, typically the victim is in a panic mode. Is my business going down? How am I going to go through this? But yeah, it's always a good idea to have a cyber policy if you're running a business, no matter what type of business you have.
Right.
Well, I love that advice to the consumers out there. I think that's great advice. What I also want to hear, and this is usually my closing question for most of the guests, is, well, knowing where you started and where you are now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I don't have any regrets, but I kind of like, yeah, I would ask myself to kind of put a little bit more thoughts on life-changing decisions.
Well, so, YOLO.
But, at least you moved to Atlanta and not like, you know, I mean, up here, the winter's up here.
Yeah, I like Atlanta weather. I like Atlanta weather. Yeah, I enjoy Atlanta. So yeah, it's a great city. So definitely, I'm not saying like I made mistake. I was just like I said before, when I was younger, I just didn't think about, probably like any younger person, didn't think much about decisions, just doing it. But yeah, sometimes it's good to kind of like step back and think about it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But sometimes the best decisions are made when you just have that feeling though too. I got to take this leap of faith. But yes, it's good idea to think about things too. Well, Milan, thank you so much for coming on. I found this super, super fascinating. And I think everyone tuning in will as well. And it's just, like, to me, it's like a whole new world. Like, it's just a crazy. I think it's like this dark universe. So I can't thank you enough for sharing your tips and just, you know, on the cutting edge of cyber. So thank you so much for joining me and us. And of course, for everyone listening, as always, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Sleep. You can find us on your favorite streaming platform as well as YouTube. I think you can find us at Claims Never Sleep Podcast on YouTube. So thanks for tuning in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep Podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell